And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this week I'm happy to welcome Sloane Crosley back to the program today. Sloane was last on to talk about her debut novel, The Clasp. She's also landed on many bestseller lists with her collections of personal essays, I Was Told There Would Be Cake, and How Did You Get This Number? Today we'll be talking about her latest collection, Look Alive Out There, which is published by MCD, an imprint of Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Now, Sloane, when you were last here, we talked about your debut novel, The Clasp. What was it like to get back to writing personal essays?
Kind of a relief, which I'm probably not supposed to say because it sounds like a betrayal, you know, like how much do you like your second kid better than your first, or in this case, I guess my fourth. But it's nice sort of, you know, with fiction, you get to make everything up whole cloth, but then everything is also you're completely responsible for. And with nonfiction, there's some things you're sort of responsible to the truth. It's a sort of different set of gods, I suppose. But you are bouncing off of something that happens in real life. And so it's sort of a relief to go back to this place where I knew sort of the plot or I knew how things ended just because it's how they happen in real life.
Did you work on any of these while you're writing your novel, or do you have to keep things siloed and
Church
separate?
And state.
Yeah.
I worked on a couple of them. So most of these I worked on afterwards. A couple of them I worked on before the novel. All of them I handed in on November 9th, 2016. So none of them have any politics in them. They're pre-Trump.
What have you written since about America's new direction?
Not much. I think you know what's funny? It's all like no matter what you believe, it's coming at you so fast and so furious that I need the kind of writing I do requires a little bit of processing. I mean, I, you know, will write the occasional op-ed, but I can't keep up with it. And it's something I'm more enjoying / horrified to read about than I am to, I don't really have a burning desire to write about it. I'm no Sean Penn.
Thank goodness for that.
I was about to say, I know Sean Penn and I'm no Sean Penn, but I don't know Sean Penn.
I'm going
to
burn that bridge right now.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Now, when you were last here, you did tell us a little bit about your research trip to France for The Clasp, and you really expanded on that in the essay Brace Yourself.
Yes. So the way the essays work for this book is that that's actually kind of a shorter essay comparatively to some of the other ones. I think there are 16 of them, and they're sort of like little, not palate cleansers, I guess, more like appetizers, some sort of food analogy, an appetizer for a longer essay that follows it.
Yeah, there are some quite long, 30, 40 pages almost.
There are some pretty serious ones, but then there are some, you know, teeny tiny ones. And Brace Yourself is sort of in between. And that's a really good, I'm glad you brought it up, because it really is a good example of how most things are pretty clearly, again, I don't know why, maybe I just haven't even lunch yet. There's just a lot of digestive references. But most things are go down one pipe or the other when you absorb them. You think this would be, you know, great for a character, this is great for a plot, or it's my life and I'm going to write about it for nonfiction. I mean, particularly when you write both fiction and narrative nonfiction. But every once in a while, there's something where I had this very funny experience in France while researching the novel, where a friend of mine and I managed to get a discounted room in this sort of falling down chateau where Guy de Maupassant used to live. And that's what the, you know, the novel features him pretty heavily. So I was so excited. And then she decided she wanted to go off and have an affair with some impossibly hot sculptor somewhere. And he took the car and ditched me. She's actually quite a good friend. This isn't painting her very well, but, but you know, as a,
she's used to getting her way.
Sort of a flighty person. Yes. I describe her as someone who would be irritating because she's just sort of stunningly beautiful if she didn't assume that all of her friends had the same sort of level of intelligence and the same looks and everything. And she just is genuinely befuddled why people, you know, we were at a gas station in France and we were parked and it was her turn to get gas. And she just sat there. And I said, what are you doing? And she said, oh, well, they'll pump it for you. I'm like, no, 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 they won't. No, they won't. You're not New Jersey. Get out of the car. Like, but long story short, those little moments that happen in the research of, you know, the novel, they can be sort of repurposed for the backstory. And it's a relief to do that.
Now, there were a couple, including that one, I can't remember the name of one, where you go to the Russian River, that you have to lade in supplies for an extended stay.
And yeah, so I have a problem with with ill-preparedness, I believe. That could be if there was just one word for the essay collection.
Well, that's in the Up the Down
book. Up the Down, yeah. I've never dressed appropriately. I mean, that's the thing is, but I'm very conscious of it. I hopefully I'm not asking for the reader's sympathy so much as I'm asking for them to shake their heads at me.
How have you survived all these years?
I don't know. Well, here's the thing. You know, when something makes an interesting story, it's because either there are outside elements that have intervened to make something ridiculous. You know, something crazy happened to your airplane. You know, that's not your fault. Maybe you're, you know, a little klutzy, which is such an annoying kind of trope, especially for women. But, you know, whatever it is. But I'm choosing these essays. So these are the moments that those extreme things have happened. It's not the same thing as memoir. If you read a whole memoir, you would know perfectly well that I'm fine. I got here today. I'll probably leave here without smacking into the door, we hope. But, you know, these are chosen for that reason.
Because there are also a couple of stories where you don't read closely and that leads to some confusion.
Yes. There's a couple like that as well.
How many of the essays were previously published elsewhere?
Two, I would say 0.5, because one was just I just blew it to smithereens and, you know, we can rebuild him and put it back together. So out of 16, they're mostly new. I mean, it's interesting. It's something I get to brag about when the book's out and say, you know, these are all brand new. Act now. But the truth is, it would be great to be, you know, David Sedaris and have a regular contract at The New Yorker and then sweep everything up into a dustpan and bind it and put it on the bestseller list. The way I write tends to be pretty long and it has a different sort of tenor than a lot of magazine pieces tend to have. So they're really meant for a book.
Because it seems strange with like a short story, a lot of people print in the literary journals or the David mm-hmm. Sedaris essays. You're writing all these things and they're not getting a kind of an immediate feedback, like or a more immediate feedback as they would in those circumstances. What's it like to have all these smaller pieces that you're just sitting there and hoping they do balance out?
So excited that this is therapy. It's difficult not to have that instant gratification, especially we live in an instant gratification world now, you know, like my tweet kind of thing. And it's always been difficult and it's especially difficult. Have you ever gotten disconnected from someone on the phone and you only realize once they call you back exactly how long you've been talking without the other person responding mm-hmm. and that you're a horrible friend and a horrible listener?
Thanks, FaceTime.
Yes. Well, it's a little bit like a long version of that. Or like being against an actor being against a green screen, you know, and you have to pretend there's a, you know, goblin that you're fighting or something like that. So it's a little strange, but at the same time, when it comes to the humor, that's a little bit tough. You know, when I'm thinking, is this funny? I don't know. I think it's funny. But when it comes to sort of the emotional depth of the essays or, you know, taking the time to examine things, this goes back to why I'm not writing about, you know, politics. It's better that that happen in a vacuum and that people aren't responding in immediate ways to that.
So when you're on Twitter, is that like a pressure release valve or do you think it lowers the well of funny that you have in you?
Well, it's Tina Fey once, you know, not gave an interview about Twitter, but was asked about Twitter during an interview. And she just said, you know, she became had this sort of possessive, you know, like hand clutched to the pearls kind of way where she said, I need my jokes. I can't just be giving them out. I get that. So it's not, if it's really something that has a larger thought to it, hopefully I can still, you know, restrain myself. I have to say, I see this in other people sometimes. I don't see things that should be full essays on Twitter, but I see, you know, an occasional, you know, in 140 or now it's 200 something characters, you can get out something that if you're a writer, often I'll think of other writers like, you should have kept that inside the house and let it percolate for a while because that would have made a wonderful op-ed. You know, which could have been published and for which, oh, I don't know, you could have been paid. So,
would you please say that to Mike Huckabee so he'll just stop?
Yeah, I mean, do I have to use the wonderful adjective?
You know, yeah, you can take that.
A marvelous, marvelous op-ed. Yeah, exactly. And but at the same time, it's very addictive and there can be good things about it. I tend to tweet pretty much how I write, just in a shorter format because how I write is so worldview and personality-based to begin with. And that's sort of what Twitter is. But I don't think there should be this pressure for authors to tweet. Every author who has a book out, you know, go tweet. And not everybody is meant to do that.
No one can be John Scalzi. And
just, exactly. Or you know who's great at it? And that we can totally talk about my book. But but who's great at it is Susan Orlean is great at it because it has nothing to do with her writing. She just genuinely wants you to know what's up. So it's genuinely about her walking the dogs and that she hit a page count today. And she's just, and it's the most, I mean, I think it's okay to say this because I think she's a wonderful writer and we all know that. It's purposefully unartful. And I find it very therapeutic.
Well, I remember she tweeted about the love for short books recently. And yeah. I tweeted back. I said, I really appreciate a 200-page novel.
I thought, nice 200-page novel. Oh, we're long time no old man in the sea.
But also saw on Twitter recently that you've got some strange plans for your signings to interact with the audience.
I just – what did I say for Oxford? It was – something about Faulkner.
Saying the past is never dead backwards.
Yes, I'm going to say that until a chosen audience member cries. I'm really trying to sell it. No, I think that it's just this idea that readings are funny. People forget – they forget that they like to be read to. You know, there's like a through line for music, for art. You just listen to different kinds of music than you did when you were 4 years old, but you don't stop. Whereas you do stop being read to. Like, how many readings did you go to in middle school? Bookstores. I don't know, maybe a lot. You went to a lot. Am I asking the wrong person? Okay. But a lot of people didn't.
Yes, in rural Arkansas, the readings are the high point of the week.
Okay.
Speaking of readings, yes. We very, very rarely have an author read from their work on the air, but I would like you to read the entire essay entitled Rite Aid for us.
Okay. The whole essay.
The whole essay.
All right. Sit down for 5 seconds. This is called Rite Aid. At my local Rite Aid works a woman who once looked at my ID and said, "We have the same birthday." She hasn't mentioned it since. I think how I might like to surprise her with this information on the day, but that will mean both that I am in a Rite Aid on my birthday and that I am still smoking cigarettes. Instead, I go in a few days before our big day in need of paper towels. I ask her if she has any exciting weekend plans. She blinks at me, processing the question. Then she tells me she only dates men. The end.
And this, add that on to in several other essays talking about your tendency to be attracted toward unavailable men.
And in this case, unavailable women.
Yeah. Just wondering if you ever got that all sorted out.
Yes, that's pretty much sorted out. Although I don't know. I think, you know, I have an essay called Relative Stranger in which I interview my distant relative who was a huge porn star in the 70s. I mean, he was in a lot of films. Just to clarify, some of Johnny's life lessons, they're still sort of correct. And the reason I wanted to talk to him is because he got into pornography because he thought he was going to find a girlfriend that way. And that seemed like a bad idea to me. But what was interesting is I really got sort of my hand slapped by Johnny by the end of the interview, which was a lovely, I mean, it's a real tribute to him and his life. But he's like, you know, these women weren't undateable by virtue of their profession. And I felt like such a horrible feminist. I'm like, of course that's true. Of course that's true. And he's like, it's just how I was relating to them and how I relate to people. And you don't suddenly become someone else. And the way he said it actually was sort of reminiscent of, you know, goodbye to all that when Joan Didion says, you know, it all counted. Every night, every mistake, you know, every procrastination, it all counted. And so who you are stays. And, you know, being attractive to someone who's unavailable doesn't really change. I think you just learn what's good for you and you learn to be attracted to other things as well.
Tell us a little bit about your elementary school therapy practice.
No,
and were you more Lucy from Peanuts or a little bit more Charlie Bartlett?
A little more Charlie Bartlett, I think. But Lucy from Peanuts is the reference in the essay. This is sort of a medium-sized essay. That one is called Our Hour is Up. Basically, I decided that I was going to be a therapist because I decided all my friends were, you know, seeking out advice about their fourth grade problems. I wish I remembered them more clearly. That's probably the most made up part of the essay, is remembering the fellow fourth grader gripes. But the essay is about what happens when I decide to become a therapist at 9.
And at the end of the story, we won't ruin it for the listeners and the readers, but I was cheering for you because I thought your response was the proper response. I am so petty that I agree with you.
Yes,
that.
Of course. There's a hopefully it's just like a hairline fracture. I don't want it to be bigger than that, but a little bit of spite here and there. I mean, hopefully they're big-hearted essays, but, you know, there's also a little spite in the essay about, you know, my neighbors and me gradually becoming unhinged by noisy neighbors until I, you know, took my vengeance in a really elaborate way on them.
But tell us more about Jared.
Jared. So Jared was the hardest. So, you know, you always have to change the names for the essays. And it's really easy. It's the easiest and it's the most fun thing to do. You're like, ooh, you know, it's like picking out things on a, you know, from a grocery store shelf.
But to get the exact right name.
But usually it comes pretty easily to me. The problem is there's a little bit, it's not a lie, but that essay is told in the past tense and I still live in that apartment. And I have these very noisy neighbors. There are these teenage neighbors where I live in a very nice neighborhood in a sort of moderately okay building. But my view is of a family with a single six-story brownstone in the West Village. And with these sort of unruly teenage kids that just turned me into like just a curmudgeon before my time. I just hated them so much. I was resentful of everything about them, their youth, their wealth, their taste in music, everything. And I just, you know, when they weren't there, I heard birds. And then when they are there, I should say, they're just total menaces. I mean, I can Shazam them from my house. So that's too close. But
they probably don't listen to great music either.
No, they do. That's the infuriating thing.
Oh, man.
It's awful. It's like Townes Van Zandt and Elvis and like really good like old school hip hop and like Charlotte Gainsbourg. It's awful. It's like it's really Serge, the dad. You know, it's just
well, Serge,
Black Angels. Like, I'm like, how do you even know about this? Like, yeah. But the point is that, you know, the Rolling Stones, it's good. But the thing is, when you don't want to hear it, it doesn't matter what it is. If it's 3 a.m. on a Tuesday and it's waking you up. So I become gradually unhinged in this essay. A little thread of vengeance in the end, but I hope that people are cheering for me to take vengeance on this kid by the end of it.
I definitely did cheer for you.
Oh, good.
Because it was just like my father's approach to getting rid of a skunk that had burrowed under the house.
Okay. There we go. Yeah, well, that's – should we – I mean
– No.
Okay,
no,
we're
no,
not going to ruin it. I don't – like, there's no murder. We should get that out of the way.
Yeah, everything's – my father did not murder a skunk.
Yeah, okay, good.
Those first two essays – that one and the one with the woman in the wheelchair in the very first one features people wronging you in terms of societal norms. And I was just wondering, if you think about it, what ways do you wrong other people via societal norms?
Oh, all the time, I'm sure. I do it all the time. I mean, I feel like less than I used to. I used to be good tipper in restaurants, bad tipper in taxi cabs, because they put in New York, they put in all these like automated screens that it's like built in and more expensive. And I'm like, you know, if I was paying you cash, I wouldn't pay you as much as I'm doing. And so I used to be not a bad tipper. It's not like I would not tip, but, you know, I'm not paying you like it's a restaurant. That's crazy. I'm not going to give you, you know, 22%. But now I'm a very good tipper because it's the only way. I don't really get recognized on the street, but I've just – the essays are out there enough. Enough is out there that when people take my credit card for things, they're like, oh, because I have a strange name. And so I'm very conscious of not wronging people by tipping them well. But that's not really – that makes it sound like I used to rob people. I don't really – I don't know if I'm that conscious of the things I do. I'm probably – maybe I'm not excellent walker. I don't know how I do it. I am conscious, however, of the fact that there is a little bit of woe is me in the book, you know, in terms of like, oh, this thing happened to me and that thing happened to me. But it's inherent to narrative nonfiction. Like, you'd be hard-pressed to find any one of these, David Rykoff or Megan Daum or David Sedaris, that isn't. If you looked at it from that prism, you'd think, wow, I guess it's just hard for you in the world, huh?
Well, I remember listening to an interview with Paul Theroux writing about travel, and that he would try to make sure things would go wrong because that would at least give him something to write about. Yeah. He tried to build enough ricketiness in there that there
would
be.
Well, he's also really a travel writer.
Yeah.
You know, there's a way that there – or the Hunter S. Thompson sort of model of like, let's just fling myself into a dark alley and see what happens. Mine's sort of – I think I might be a slight magnet for it.
Also, do you think without that irritation, would you be able to produce pearls?
Oh, I can become irritated at nearly anything. I don't underestimate if hard pressed. Yeah, I mean, etiquette's a real focus for me.
Now, in the essay in A Dog Named Humphrey, you talk about getting a cameo on the TV show Gossip Girl. Mm-hmm. And it just made me think that you one-upped John Jeremiah Sullivan when his house was used for One Tree Hill. You actually got on the show. It was just his house
got
on the
show. Although his was more – actually, I saw him the other night. We were talking about this. And I bow down to his essay about One Tree Hill taking over his actual home, because his is more about like the infiltration of TV, and mine is more about the quest or the search for identity. He has a little bit more meat on the bone, let's put it that way, in terms of, I mean, these people really were living in and took over his house and changed the furniture around for months. Whereas while I might have actually gotten on a show and been part of that universe, I think I had 4 lines. So if you look at it that way.
And you weren't super happy with those lines.
Well, the lines, listen, I would have been happy with anything. So this is all under the umbrella. And I think it's clear in the essay that I'm like, this is really, really cool. Because most essays, the whole point is this universality of that humor of exasperation. Don't you just hate it when? This essay is different because it's not like, oh, don't you just hate it when you've got a cameo on a TV show and they, you know, don't feed you? I mean, how ridiculous. But that's the whole thing. It's supposed to be just like a little spy into that strange world. But the lines, I was so excited to get them. I mean, I really had no – I mean, they offered it originally to a more famous writer, is who I say it is in the book, but I can tell you now it was Fran Lebowitz, and she said no. And in the essay I say, you know, the fact that she said no had no effect on me whatsoever. I'm like, I still want to do it. But the lines – I'm introduced at a book party for a fictional book for one of the characters, and – young woman who plays a literary agent brings me over to some of the more recurring characters and says, this is Sloane Crosley, the best-selling author of I Was Told There'd Be Cake. And I just cannot imagine a scenario in real life where that wouldn't be just the most humiliating way to introduce somebody. And I have to sort of smile, and then, you know, the cake jokes follow me around a little bit. So then my line bouncing off of that is, of which I am still in search of, which is not only a sort of pretty low-hanging fruit cake, low-hanging cake joke, but it's grammatically incorrect. But I felt like I had to say it because I was such a guest star, so I couldn't. I'm like, that's actually okay. I'll just say it.
Well, they were introducing you to the audience.
Yes, no, that part I understood. Yeah. It's not that it's more the of which I am still in search of. It was a little rough.
You talk about how this literary party is more harkening back to the ones of the 70s and not the contemporary.
Yes. Well, as we all know, and I don't think anyone in the world needs to be told this, you know, like the apartment in Friends is not the apartment you have in New York City. And the same thing is true the other way around. Like the house in Gilmore Girls is not the like perfect, adorable little house you have everywhere. If you live in San Francisco, it's not Full House. Like those houses are millions of dollars.
All the houses in Stars Hollow are like that.
They're all ridiculous. Freaking Stars Hollow. But basically, so similarly, it was this funny thing, like book publishing is not what it used to be financially, and it's this sort of grand party for a debut of the guy, I'm actually forgetting his name, starts with a P, who plays Dan Humphrey. Anyway, he also, in this episode, has scored a short story in The New Yorker in high school, which is real normal. You know, although in the essay I do mention that, you know, what's interesting is how it bleeds over in weird ways, and maybe it's, you know, in these days of youth prize scribes, maybe it's not that weird, do you know? I mean, I think the writers are debuting younger and younger. Maybe it's because the internet. I don't know what it is. And so that's good. But it's also like, oh, wow, like, how can this 12-year-old describe menopause so well, you know?
Well, and you do mention your age throughout several of the essays.
Do I harp on it? Maybe I do.
I just mentioned it a few times, okay. But it's my job to look for commonalities.
Of course,
and
yes, that makes
disparate
sense.
Pieces. Yeah. And I was just wondering if you've gotten any more empathy for people of my age or your parents' age in the aging process.
Of course. There are a couple of jokes that I remember discussing with my editor where even in writing it, I thought, let me know if this is funny enough to be insulting. Do you know? Because I think that's sort of the litmus test you have to pass. Dorothy Parker used to say that humor should always be used as a shield and never as a sword.
Part of me doesn't quite agree.
Well, I agree with most things Dorothy Parker says, although she did swallow a bottle of shoe polish, so there's that. But you know, she didn't write a full length. You know, I think when you have a certain amount of real estate to cover, it's hard to consistently make it a shield. You know, we're not talking about shorter pieces. But there are a couple. There's one line that I'm actually a little self-conscious about in the book where I get very sick. I have an inner ear disease, and it's a weird one that's not that weird, slightly rare, but it's also not many people my age have it. It's a thing that a lot of people get as they get older. It's just a sort of dizziness, vertigo thing. And I talk about sitting in this waiting room with people who are, you know, minimum 20, but like really on average, like 60 years older than I am. And this man looks at me and he has this sort of sympathetic look because he can tell from the way I'm sitting that I'm trying not to move my head in a certain way. And, you know, kind of boy, had he been there. And I say that I appreciated the sympathy, but I don't want to be a part of any club that can't remember its own handshake. And Like every once in a while, that's right there on the edge. Well, when I isolate it, like I did just now, you know, and you don't, you know, you don't have the empathy that hopefully comes with reading an essay in context. It sounds pretty bad, you know, and so I am a little conscious of those. But honestly, it's to me, it's not that much. It's like one or two lines out of all. I don't think it's like an ageist book. So,
but in the age of the instant outrage cycle on the internet,
oh, it could be worse. I mean, it could be. I mean, I think about, you know, Lena Dunham being accused of molesting her sister for some essay she wrote. You know, I don't think I'm anywhere near that. So it's. I said a bad thing about an old person, but also I said a true thing about an old person, you know, where it's just, I mean, that's the position I was in. And that's the position I was in, is thinking I have this before my time, and I'm sort of immersed in the unfairness of that and grappling with that. And is it unfair? Or is it just sort of like, hey, that's what happens. Yeah. I mean, that's how it feels. I mean, and a lesser version of that, a more common version that you probably wouldn't think was weird if I was on the other side of it would be, you know, occasionally an elevator door will open and some 22-year-old will let me go out first. And I'm trying not to, you know, sort of like cold cock her in the face. Probably not. But, you know, but there's a little part. But I think about how I feel, you know, as you get older, you experience more of those moments kind of on the back end. And you're like, oh, well, that's kind and yet also insulting.
Now, I did have pharmaceutically induced vertigo.
Oh, my gosh. Why?
Well, sorry. No, it wasn't intentional. It was a side effect. I was coming off.
Oh, pharmacy. Okay, for a second. Got it.
Yeah, I was coming off a medicine, and it was terrible for 2 weeks. I couldn't drive myself to work.
Right.
When I came to work, I could only sit down. I couldn't.
Did it wake you up?
It did not wake me up.
Okay.
But it was.
Still bad.
It was still bad, but not as bad as yours.
No. That's not where I was, it doesn't. It's not a contest.
But yeah, because then it was only 2 weeks. But I mean, radically changed my life for 2 weeks.
Well, it's also one of these things where the delicacy of our lives is so interesting. The delicacy of our bodies and how easily we can sort of be just knocked off our course is really sort of fascinating in a way that it just seems like a whole new world. And that's how and probably to you too, it probably seemed endless. And it's sort of in the essay about it, I sort of try to draw the comparison between medical writing and travel writing, because it does feel like you're visiting a new country. But the difference is with travel writing is people want to hear your like scraps and funny little stories about, you know, missed flights and who was sat next to you on the plane and all of that. Nobody ever says like, oh, you're going to the pharmacy, like, take pictures, bring me back something.
I don't know. With the Instagram age.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. I did Instagram. Yeah, I've Instagrammed pharmacy shelves before. Just because I did one in the UK once because there was a shelf full of nuts with a giant sign above it that said may contain nuts. So I could not.
Was that in a boots or?
Yes. Well done. Yes, it was in a boots.
In that essay with your inner ear problem and then in The Woman as a Doctor talking about fertility issues, are there any lines out there that you won't cross in talking about yourself? Do you only protect other people or do you think you're pretty much an open book?
I'm trying to imagine. I really wanted to say I'm an open ebook, but I don't know what that means. It just seems like a funny twist on that phrase.
I switched on ebook.
I don't know what it means though. But no, I mean, I'm mostly protective of other people, both in how I write about them, also like the duration. You know, I know I always take the worst thing. If anything is negative about someone, I usually take the worst thing I know. Was it like Coco Chanel who said you should get dressed and take one thing off? I take the worst thing I know out. And I change the name and I change the identifying characteristics and stuff like that. And I make sure that it's not just me viciously, you know, going around stabbing people. But for me, of course, there are things I won't touch, but it's not because I'm private about them. It's because I don't think they're funny enough. If I can't make it funny and I can't make it entertaining, I mean, that's the difference, the sort of misunderstanding, I think a contemporary misunderstanding of the confessional essay, which has gotten like such a bad name because it's just, you know, rejected modern love columns of, you know, oh my gosh, I slept with my grandfather's ghost. I'm like, why? What is happening here? You know, and it's just this sort of information emo dump, which is not really the same thing as an essay, which hopefully is entertaining or educating or something. And so the stories I hold back aren't because I'm really private about them. It's just because I don't think they're funny.
The Woman as a Doctor riddle that the title of the story comes from. I remember hearing that on MASH when I was a kid. That was the first place I ever heard it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so funny. Last night I did an event and someone asked me what TV show I would watch if I could only watch one TV show for the rest of time. And there are so many answers, but out came MASH. And I think the reason I said it was just mathematics. I'm like, it's just long. There's just a lot of it.
You'll have a lot.
It's just a lot of it. And it's funny.
In the piece, You Someday Lucky, you talk about the personality assessment system, the Enneagram.
Do you know the Enneagram?
Yes. I dated a woman about 10 years ago, and she was a proponent of the Enneagram, so I had to take the test.
How'd you guys break up?
Very, very, very horribly.
Yeah, I bet.
It was bad. She said some really mean things to me.
Well, she knows your personality type.
I wasn't quite Hitler, but but I am a six.
It's rough. Sorry, people don't know what this is.
Well,
but go ahead.
Tell us a little bit about the Enneagram and why your nineness was in question.
Why my nineness was in question. So basically, I mean, that's a good example of an essay that, you know, I used to work full-time in an office before I became a writer, which can be rare for there a lot of writers that either haven't or they – if they do work in an office, it's not the same thing as having a whole separate career where, you know, I like ran a department of people and we were like family together. That I had this coworker who had this sort of especially like he was from Boulder and so was his wife. And I was just sort of really like entranced by them. I just, you know, I think in New York when you can function and still be really sort of chill and be on your own time and enjoy the pleasures of a hammock, it's this valuable thing that you're not just wound up like a spring. That's the noise for spring, I guess. I'm sure it sounded bad. But anyway, so one night, my coworker said, you know, why don't you come over and we'll figure out your personality number. And I was very confused because I thought, you know, is it like the zodiac? I mean, is it like astrology or numerology? And he's like, no, no, no. It's this sort of ancient process by which one is asked endless questions that are really specific. This isn't like the Myers-Briggs test or Tony Robbins. This is like really like, you know, your response to animal attacks. And if you're in a party, are you on the edge of the party or in the middle of the party? Are you talking for half of the party? Do you know, like, it's so close to asking you, like, do you, like, when you take an appetizer, where do you put the stick? Like, it's very, very specific. And then afterwards, a number sort of pops out the other end, which I'm making it sound very Willy Wonka-ish. And they were very delighted to know that my personality type after the end of this was a 9 because they were also both 9s. And then I did something at work, and this is sort of the point of the essay, that changed how he thought of me, and he decided to change my number to a 6. And I said, you know, we were talking about other people we knew, and I said, well, I don't think we know any 6s. And, you know, we were typing to each other from the next office, and I could hear him typing. And then all of a sudden this sentence appears on my screen, and it says, well, Hitler was a 6. Anyway.
Well,
it's a short essay, so that really that's all of it.
And worse, Bono is a 6, too.
Oh, Bono is a 6?
Yeah, that's what at least it said.
That makes sense.
I went
though.
To the Enneagram.
There's a real through line between Hitler and Bono.
I went to the Enneagram Institute webpage to look up the numbers.
Gosh.
And number 9 is the peacemaker, the easygoing, self-effacing type, receptive, reassuring, agreeable, and complacent.
That's so funny. I don't feel like I'm any of those things.
Yeah, and I don't think you're complacent.
I think I'm reassuring.
I don't think you're complacent. you're self-effacing.
Self-effacing. But it's only these things. Have you ever I don't put any stock in any of it, or I think I don't, until you ever spot check someone else's horoscope. That's a good way to find out if this stuff is sort of bull or not.
You agree with all of them to some point.
Well, but the thing is, I sometimes don't. I'm like, you know what? Aries does not apply to me. Huh.
Well, I look through all the descriptions of all the 9 different types. I'm going, yeah, I'm definitely not that.
Not?
But probably 4 of them, you know, had
there's,
some
of course there's going to be overlap. Well, because it works like it's like a color chart, you know, or just, you know, it's you know, primary colors that are just sort of in all these. That essay is a good example of an essay that precedes a longer essay that has the next essay that follows that one. Is about me going to write in Northern California and accidentally befriending my pot-growing, swinging neighbors in the next house. And so given what I just said, I think you can see like how it's like a little appetizer for like, okay, this is like
how's she gonna
Sloan
to
goes to the woods. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And it's happened to all of us. Come on.
Maybe. Maybe these, you know, but there are some things that are very normal that are still worth examining.
Now, in one of the longer pieces, which had appeared elsewhere, Up the Down Volcano, you write about taking this trip to Ecuador.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned Paul Theroux earlier. You weren't intentionally wanting things to go wrong, but you were so ill-prepared. I mean, how many different ways were you ill-prepared?
Well, part of it was purposeful ill-preparedness in the fact that I went to Ecuador because a small travel magazine told me to go. And they have a feature called, it's called Afar Magazine. They have a feature that I think they still do called Spin the Globe, where they don't tell you where you're going until 24 hours before you're going there. I mean, they tell you certain things, like if you need like a tetanus shot or, you know, malaria, that kind of stuff. Actually, malaria pills, typhus, tetanus you would have had, typhus shot. So part of it was the atmosphere of sort of not knowing what I was doing was already in the air, and that kind of spontaneity was already in the air. And I asked friends what I should do while I was in Ecuador, and one of them said, you know, oh, you should go to this museum, and another said you should, you know, go to this bar, and in Quito specifically, and another said you should climb Cotopaxi. And I thought, oh, good, a hike. That's fun. I'll do that. And apparently I just could not be bothered to Google it. Just couldn't do it. And great, I'll just get somebody. I'll get a guide. Or I didn't even think I needed a guide. I thought that was a little elaborate and fancy. Like, why don't I just go? And then I wrote for the magazine. I had already written the piece for the magazine. Is about me, like, basically kind of trying to crash the Ecuadorian version of the Oscars. Like, it has nothing to do with this. And that's what's kind of funny, is it's not in the book, but it's weird to see them side by side of how quickly things can change in your life. And it's just this sort of, you know, I mean, perfectly charming, competent piece that fulfilled the assignment. And then I had an extra day, and I thought, well, I'm gonna go climb that little hill that turns out to be the highest active volcano in the hemisphere, over 20,000 feet, or maybe it's 19,000 something. And Quito, without even trying, is 8,000 feet above sea level. The supermodel of cities, it just wakes up 8,000 feet above sea level. And so I also didn't speak and do not speak Spanish. That was a slight problem. And so I had these communication problems with my guide, who kept telling me what I was wearing was fine. And we had a miscommunication about how long I had been acclimating in the country. And before I knew it, I was very high up a mountain with acute altitude sickness, seeing spots. But, you know, in a fun way. Like, you would ask me, because you would ask before, you know, what would I write about? Like, and how did you get this number in my last book? A bear gets hit by a car. But it's, you know, it's uproarious in its own way. But, yeah.
I went to Albuquerque last month, and I was at 6,000 feet, and I got ill.
And you, yeah, just from landing or driving?
Driving.
You got ill from driving to Albuquerque?
Well, yeah. I mean,
didn't you get acclimated as you were driving? No,
it's a pretty sharp ramp up from from eastern New Mexico is flat,
right?
And so it's just,
and all of a sudden, there
all
you
of
are.
A sudden you're up at Sandia Peak and you're 6,000-7,000.
Yeah, and it's altitude. I mean, did you? It just feels like, listen, it feels like a horrible, horrible hangover. You know, it's just headachy and feverish. And then I had in some in-between stage where I was also seeing things.
Yeah.
But, like, then there's, like, the John Krakauer level where, like, you know, you get frostbite in your retina. I mean, that's not going to happen to people. People out there still climb mountains. You should.
Well, and it was because it was so dry. It's, you know, the end of the winter, and the dew point was negative 13.
Ooh.
And I just dehydrated massively almost immediately when I got there.
I'm sure. Just spontaneously.
I just desiccated.
You're just, the raw food movement is very big up there. You just put a mango up there, and next thing you know, it's dry.
When we talked last time, you talked about getting back to essays. Do you have any plans to move back to fiction?
I do. I am. I did. I have.
You've already turned in the manuscript?
The last two sound a little more promising, and the first two were more accurate, probably, tense-wise. I have about 50,000 words of a novel, but that doesn't really mean anything. I mean, I could be filibustering. It could be just rewriting the phone book, but it's not. It's pretty good so far. And so right now I'm obviously promoting Look Alive out there and focused on that. And then when I come back, it's back to the grind.
In terms of the title, Look Alive Out There, is it more that you're coaching the reader or you are being coached?
It's neither, I guess. Or actually, well, closer to the second. It's funny because there is the, like, sports, you know, the concept of, like, put me in, coach, you know, or just like a coach, like, sort of like giving a pat on the butt of a football player and being like, look alive out there, Jimmy. You know, and it doesn't – but I think it's meant more – sort of sadly, like, look alive out there. Not so much like I'm walking here, hey, but just sort of this idea of, like, oh, I guess I have to pay attention to this now. This sort of exasperated thing. But at the same time, sort of embedded in it is kind of hopefully like a positive spirit, if that makes sense. But it's not really meant. I think it's meant for whoever reads it.
Well, thanks for putting up with me for a half hour. So
no, it was lovely. Thank you for having me. I'm glad I didn't fall down.
Thank you. Sloane Crosley is the author of the essay collection Look Alive Out There, which is published by MCD, an imprint of Farrar, Straus & Giroux. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.